This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arun Galadima. Let's start the show. I'm excited to bring you guys today's guest, Mr. Audu Mekwari. Audu is a Nigerian lawyer, an entrepreneur, social activist, public speaker, and creative industry professional in the music industry in Nigeria. He is the founder and president of Chocolate City Entertainment, and he's also known as one of the judges for the first season of Nigerian Idol. He's won multiple awards throughout his career. One of them includes the International Young Music Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2007. Audu, I've given a very brief introduction, but can you please take the time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better?
Okay, hi. Hi, everybody. Hi, bandits. In my profession, bandits are, you know, people you need to be careful with. But I guess these are the good bandits.
Yes, really good ones.
Primarily, I like to think of myself as a change agent. I'm somebody who's really passionate about being able to effect changes where I can, especially in areas where I see problems. And I think essentially that's what an entrepreneur is. An entrepreneur is a problem solver. The typical entrepreneur is looking for a problem so they can have a solution and so that they can make some money as well and add value. So that's really what has, I think, been what has sort of driven most of the things that I get involved in, which is, if there's an issue, let's look at the issue. Let's see if we can fix that issue. And if we can, and we can do it properly, then people can pay us money for that value that we're adding. So that is what I do in summary.
Okay. That's really interesting. I like how the money, you mentioned the money comes after you're able to produce some sort of product. I mean, I was just speaking with someone the other day, and they said one of the issues is entrepreneurs oftentimes want to get in and start making money right away without mastering their product or service or whatever it is they're offering. So I like that you stated it in that order. When did you start Chocolate City, and I guess what prompted you to want to start the label?
So Chocolate City as a company, as a legal entity, started in 2003, was registered in 2003, and we started operations in about late 2004 and early 2005. Just speaking about the sequence of my conversation, I remember my statement earlier, is the fact that I've always been of the opinion that money is never the problem. Money has never been the problem. It's always about value. You see, what most people miss is that they want to make money first and then they add value later. It really just doesn't work like that in any business. You need to add value first and people pay for that value. And if you can continue to refine the service, then people continue to pay for that service, whatever it is, or the product or whatever it is. So I think that's very key, because once you think about entrepreneurship simply as a means by which you can make money, and which is, you know, in the long term, that's really what it is all about. I think it's just about how you sequence the process that determines to a large extent how successful you will be. Because remember that success is not just about having, you made a windfall, $10 million, fantastic. But that may be the only money you ever earn in your life. And you know how money is, it always eventually gets spent anyway, you know. So it's really about being able to collect $100 for the next 10 years every day of your life, as opposed to getting $10 million one day for the rest of your life, you know. I mean, and in some instances, depending on how you even create value, that money is enough. It is enough. But I would say that for an entrepreneur, because you see, the typical entrepreneur is always trying to is always trying to put their hands onto something. It's the whole process that excites them. You know, it's not just about making money, but it's giving value while making that money, typically, you know. So I think that is the difference between an entrepreneur and maybe a businessman or a hustler, you know, because they have different sort of objectives. Now, in terms of what led to establishing Chocolate City, I grew up in a family that the arts was a core part of. And I did have musical lessons when I was younger. I did fine art in school, and I excelled quite well in that. So I've typically been a creative person. myself. Just that I didn't have the talent, musically speaking, anyway. Mm. So it only made sense to learn a lot about the industry. And when Chocolate City started, it started originally when I was in University of Jos around 1997. Mm. So that's 20 years now, 21 years. No, 30 years.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah, close. Yeah,
no, it's not 30 years. It's 20 years. 20 years, since I started about that. Mm. And 21 years. And basically the idea then was that we were in school and a bunch of us got together, and school was really, you know, when your midterm, for those of you who are schooled in Nigeria, sometimes your midterm and nothing is happening. You're broke. You can't go back home and ask for more money from your parents. And, you know, you can't leave school either. And we just had to point the idea about us doing something that could, you know, create some fun in school and also make some money. And the idea was hats about doing a weekly rave. So every Friday, we would find a venue. It could be a hotel or some lobby somewhere, and then get a DJ, sell drinks and make money off of that and just repeat. So that's really sort of how that started. And, around 2001, I was during my youth corps. I was, my friend, my business partner and I started something called the Guild of Artists and Poets. And the Guild of Artists and Poets was basically a, we call it an art appreciation society, but primarily it was just a place where people who were creative, who wrote or danced or did anything in the creative sector, could come and express their art. And we started off with the first meeting. We had seven of us, and about 3 months we're doing numbers of 40 something every week.
Wow.
And then that expanded. My partner Paul moved to Jos for work, and he started a gap there. And I moved to Lagos after a while and started a gap there as well. So at a point in time, we had three gaps. Every Sunday, if you're in any of these three places, you could be sure that there's a gap meeting taking place between 5 and 7 in those spots. And that sort of brought me into close proximity with creative people, writers, dancers. And then it was clear that while we tried to support the creative people, it was clear that it wasn't enough to do it with charity. There needed to be a commercial point to it because it wasn't sustainable. You can't go and ask him for contributions or donations each time. So it made sense to kind of focus on a more commercial thing. And that sort of birthed the idea of creating a management company that focused on different things, from film to music to events to management. So that's sort of where it started from.
Interesting. Yeah, I like how there's this natural progression. You started something and you discovered something else that needed to happen in the market and you pursued it. It's not like you started with a very massive, grandiose idea. And I mean, sometimes there are different ways to do things, but I hear often what makes business successful is if you're doing something that people need or you're doing something that there's a need in the market for. So I think that's a really great lesson that bandits can draw out from that. So you mentioned the gap meetings that you were having. What was the core of that? What were you getting out of that?
So the gap meeting, even if I say so myself, was and is the coolest thing that I've ever attended, really, because the idea was quite simple. We found out that, for instance, we could spend weekends over a beer, right? And we'll be talking about all sorts of things, from Scientology to time travel. We'll be talking about people's cultures to politics. And we found out that there's so much wealth of information that was going on, was being passed around then, but it wasn't being harnessed. So the idea behind the gap was simple. It was based around the idea of open discussions and interactions in a democratic sort of setting. So a typical gap meeting would be maybe 15, 20 people, and it would start on time. Now, we would have something called the gap chair, and the gap chair was primarily the person who was hosting the meeting for that week. So we used to rotate that. So everybody got a chance to be a chair of a gap meeting at some point in time or the other. And usually we would nominate it by voting. Like, okay, so who should chair next week's meeting? Oh, it's Aram. Okay, all right, Aram. How many votes? 20 votes. Great. You're the one doing the meeting next week. And when you're doing the meeting, you need to prepare. And the meeting typically would have a theme. So if we're having, let's say the theme is time travel, for example, people go on and do research about time travel, read books, articles. They could write something. They could write a poem. They could even do a little play that they want to show. It could be a monologue. I mean, it could be anything really that they wanted to do. And they would present it before the Gap. And the Gap was very, you know, it's the kind of place that you need to be ready. Like, people would cut you down. And people will, I mean, if you do well, they're like, ah, fantastic. Of course, we didn't allow, I mean, one part of the rules was not to allow people to be insulted. So it had to be constructive criticism. So you could say, we like this, but we think we need to improve on this. Now, that forum gave us the platform to entertain all sorts of creative people. So you'd have fine actors and actresses. I can recall that the first time Abuja people saw Plantation Boys, Face came to a Gap meeting and he performed for us. You know, this was 2002 or three, really. And people were so excited. They'd never seen it before. You know, we had people like 6 foot plus. We had people like, I mean, a lot of those guys who were doing hip hop then. We had HB, who was a big rock star then, performed. You know, so it was that we would have people from the French Cultural Center, for example, and they'd probably do a French movie and translate it to English. Just those kind of interactions, the British Council, the Italian Embassy, just working with those kind of partners. Because what we wanted was a very deep cultural discourse and interaction that helped us understand their culture while they understood ours. Now, it was in the midst of doing the Gap meetings that many of us, for example, my real experience in speaking in public, or to at least that number of people on a regular basis was at Gap meetings. Because typically, like I said, a Gap meeting could have 20 to 50 people in that meeting. And as officials and as founders, even if there was a Gap chair, we'd have to do admin stuff, like make introductions, introduce people and get things. So you needed to speak to probably that number of people when you're explaining your point. And so we had things like, oh, every voice should be heard, mind the Gap, nobody's greater than the Gap, just those kind of democratic principles. And then the last thing was that we all sat in a circle. So nobody was being talked to. We're all one in that circle. You know, so that's primarily what it was. And that exposed us and to many problems that creative people were having, contractual issues, no management. They didn't know how to promote their music. They didn't have an audience. Nobody would speak for them. And they didn't know exactly how to structure those deals. So we had a pool of resources within the membership, which was really broad. It could be professors, doctors, lawyers, hustlers, anybody. The Gap was open for that. So primarily that's sort of what it did. And from the Gap came the need to establish Chocolate City formally, because my partner and I were like, look, you know, we need to do something because clearly there's a problem right here. People don't have professional management. And so we set up Chocolate City primarily to be professionally run and done, operate local, but act global.
Interesting. And so when you started Chocolate City, when you made that sort of transition, did the Gap meetings stop or do they still go on today?
Oh, no. I hate talking about this. This is the part I'm doing. Because the Gap actually went on for 10 years. We actually stopped meeting in 2012. So that's after about 11 years. Yeah, about 11 years. So we had a good run. But basically, life happened, became much busier. In 2012, I relocated to Lagos. My partner was in between different cities as well. And the other people who, cause we're actually even planned, we're even handed over the Gap to a younger generation, really. But they also were in that point with their careers that some of them traveled to school and they didn't kind of were able to hand over to the next. So it died. Now, what is interesting about this though is that we are currently in the process of restarting it. Yes, we are. And in fact, on Facebook just earlier today, I was posting some old poetry. And last week, somebody posted some about Gap. So there's a whole reprise that's going on. So we intend to make the Gap bring the Gap back. And hey, if you want to run Gap where you are, we'll be happy to give you a license, send you all the documentation, and we can start.
Awesome. No doubt. I was just about to ask about that and see if it's open to people digitally. Because I think there are a lot of us that have acquired a lot of information, and then even people who want to go back to Nigeria or want to go back to their respective countries, having a base where they can share information and understand what it's like and prepare before coming back.
Sure. Why not? So we will have that discussion offline.
Okay.
Offline. Yeah, we definitely will.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so you start Chocolate City. What did that process look like as you started to become a little bit more official in your dealings in terms of managing artists? Like, when did that come about, when you signed your first few artists, and what was that process like?
Well, I mean, so it really was, it was great seeing, you know, for me, I still think that the greatest reward for the business that we do is seeing an idea or a wager come to life, because it's really a wager. When you decide that you're going to sign an artist, you're taking a bet, and the odds are really 1 out of 10 that succeed. 1 out of 10 artists, typically. So it's a high risk business, and I think for me, it's exciting when you see them from nobodies to somebodies, and then also developing some other people to become somebodies as well. For me, that is the greatest reward. It's the fact that you can see that somebody has lifted his family out of poverty, and they can do things for their family. They can pay for their kids' school fees, or buy cars, or, you know, just add value to other people, and also start of their own businesses as well. For me, that is the greatest reward. And we got to a point whereby that started happening. And with growth comes a lot of changes, you know. And was also being able to manage those changes, and also moving from, okay, you're the startup guy who started something from nothing. You were doing everything at a point in time, and over a period of time, you're hiring more people, and the organization's getting bigger, and your responsibilities are also getting bigger. But you realize you can't focus on those small things anymore, right? You need to begin to expand the vision and look at the next thing and the next thing. And that's primarily what the job of a CEO is. It's about visioning. You know, in the beginning is a mission. After a while, it's about the vision and ensuring that that aligns with the people who are going to be the missionaries as well. So, yeah, I mean, that sort of happened midstream. In the midst of all this, there are, of course, the transition from being a regular person who people may have heard of but didn't know, and then being the person that people walk up to you and say, hey, you're this guy, right? And then you can't lose your privacy. You know, and you're not able to do the things that you like doing before anymore freely. You can't go to certain places anymore without somebody walking up to you and saying, hey, what's up? Sign me, or can we talk business or something? But also being able to be, to balance that out with being accessible at the same time. Because as a businessman, you need to be, and especially if you run a company, you are the chief marketing officer, you're the chief operations officer, you are the face of the company, and therefore it's no longer about you anymore. It's about something that has outgrown you. You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I just sort of, you speaking is sort of jogging my memory, where I'm thinking of Crowd Mentality by MI, and I feel like that's, for me, that's probably the first time that I really knew about Chocolate City. And I feel like for many people, that's when it rose to prominence in their mind and in the industry. So when this song came out, I mean, oftentimes people might think the song comes out and it's a good song and that's what brings success. But I'm sure that there was a lot driving. There was a whole engine behind that song, pushing and trying to capitalize on the success of it and build on for the future. Can you talk a little bit about that period in terms of signing MI and then Ice Prince, Jesse, and then just the progression from there?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, the first artist was Jeremiah Gang. It wasn't MI. MI was the second artist we signed.
Okay.
The first artist, do you know Jeremiah Gang?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. So I literally, through Gap, I met a guy called 6 Foot Plus.
Okay.
6 Foot Plus is a guy who rapped in Nabaka.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. He's a guy who rapped on it. So one day he played that song for me. After one of our GAP meetings, he said, oh, he came by, and we're sort of managing 6 foot plus because we're trying to help him. We thought he was very talented, but didn't have the kind of team behind him to help him grow. And this is Abuja, remember that. And Abuja isn't the hub of anything. At that time, it wasn't the hub of anything serious. It was a holiday. It was a place where people left during the weekends and traveled.
Yeah.
In 2004 or 5, Abuja was not fun. It was the kind of place that you come in for work, and then Friday, Saturdays, go somewhere else, Joss or anywhere else, and then come back. Mm-hmm. And so when we met, I recall the conversation, and I said, who is this dude? When I heard the voice. And then he said, oh, this guy called Jeremiah again. So the next day I was in church, and I saw the CD, Nabaka, Jeremiah again. I bought it, and I played the album. And I said, Jesus Christ, literally. I said, who the hell is this guy? You know? So I was asking people about him. They said, well, they didn't know him. They've heard one funny song. I mean, people didn't really know, right?
Yeah.
Some people had heard the song. Some people hadn't, but they didn't know who he was. And so I told 60 Plus, I said, this dude is awesome. What is he doing? He said, oh, he's in Just Chilling. I said, chilling? What the hell is he doing Just Chilling? So, I mean, there and then we got together. At, you know, by this time, we decided, Paul Okugo and Yahaya Mekori, my elder brother, and I, we had now decided to come together to form Chocolate City. And even though originally I brought them on board as directors, well, originally I just registered the company and kept it because, like, we'll do something, you know. So we now formalized the engagement and we said, okay, look. And I told them about the guy and they liked the music. I said, look, I'm going for this dude. Now, meanwhile, Paul was in Joss already. Like I told you, he was working in Joss at British American Tobacco as a brand manager.
Okay.
And so I called him. I said, look, there's this dude. He's in Joss. I need to see this guy, man. He says, okay. So we drove down to Joss, got in there. I met him. I met Paul. And then we got a description, called Jeremiah. He gave us a description to his house. So we said we'd come at some point in time. And then we came in, parked the car. And as we walked out, it's a place called NTC Gardens. I don't know if you know that place in Joss. Mm-hmm. It's called NTC Gardens, somewhere near that roundabout, you know. So we parked the car, walked in, and we saw this little boy by the corner, sitting down, playing with his phone. So like, hi, like, we're here to see Jeremiah again. He said, okay, who wants to see him? I said, us. So I mean, what are your names? So my name's Aldous. Okay. He said, I am Jeremiah. It was the funniest thing because this skinny little boy with that, I said, you're not Jeremiah. I mean, not the guy I heard on that song. I mean, a small body like this can't contain this kind of voice, you know, that kind of thing. And I said, no, I am Jeremiah. So I was like, okay, whatever, you know, just take us to the studio. So we walked down and I didn't believe it was him until he opened the files on his computer and started playing us music. I said, Jesus, this is Jeremiah, right? And so we got talking and basically we just told him, look, you can have a bigger career than this. You're here and just doing nothing. Your song is getting some airplay, but it needs to get airplay everywhere. At this time, we'd even discovered that the music was being played in Lagos, right? But with no real promotion. So there's a guy called Ibrahim something. He's a Just guy as well, the Just Connection, as usual. Yeah. And he was like sort of head of programming at Cool FM in Lagos. And he took it upon himself to push the track. So we were having some airplay there. And I told him, I said, look, we need to get into a management and a recording contract. We'll send you, we'll give you a contract. You read it, get your lawyer, look at it. And then I'll call you in another 2 or 3 weeks and think about it. If you want to work with us, it'll be great for us to work together. Let's see what we can do to work with you to blow your, I mean, to take your career to the next level. And let's just say that was the beginning. So the rest is history. I guess, you know, just to move on quickly, but it was through Jeremiah that I met MI.
Okay.
Now, what was interesting also was that MI was a GAP member in Joss, and so was Jesse Jags. So they knew Paul because Paul obviously was the GAP chairman there or the GAP president right there. But his name was, he was known then as Mike Grep. So MI comes from a name called, the name is actually from Mike Grep, right? That was his stage name then. And it was from the word amigo. He was called amigo, I guess, when he was in school in the US. So they just got the A, the M-I, G-O, you know, something like that. So it was M-I. So that's how it kind of progressed to that. And then, of course, with you see, you're hearing it first on the Bandit.
You know, I know. I mean, there have been a lot of theories as to what it stands for. I mean, he said a few different things himself also, but I think now that that it's coming out, we have the exclusive drop for that.
from the source. Yes. From the source. Yeah, you know, from the pseudo source. So, what happened then was, so MI was also, of course, Jude Abaga. Mm-hmm. So Paul was telling me about a guy called Jude that, oh, the guy raps, he and his brother, they have some kind of thing that they do in Jaws. They're quite good. And he has used them for one or two of the promotional shows they've done. Jeremiah and I are on the plane going to Lagos for one of our promotional tours in Lagos. And he is playing his disc band there. And he says, hey, Aldo, I want you to listen to one of my guys. His name is Mike Grepp. So they play the song, and the name of the song is War. You know, I still have the track somewhere here. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to the delivery like, wow. You know, like, who's this dude? So, ah, no, some guy, you know, Jude, his name's Mike Grepp, sorry, blah, 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 blah. So I said, okay, cool. I'd like to hear more of his stuff. And so Jeremiah tells Jude, and what was quite interesting about it was, when we'd moved back, we're in Lagos for a while, and then we're back in Abuja. Mm. And MI would come to the office and hang out, or he would stop by my house, because Jeremiah was staying in my house. When he was in Abuja, he would stay in my place, my apartment. Mm. I had a two-bed place, so he would come in and hang out. And so after a while, he'd come in and just drop, like, oh, hear this song, hear that song. Then one day he dropped a CD of like 7-8 songs, which had the Loopy Boys on it, Ruby, Ice, Jesse, Lindsay, and I listened to it, like, and I heard the song. I said, wow, these guys did this, you know? Mm. So I started taking them seriously. I'm like, okay, this really sounds like some really good music. Mm. And then crowd mentality. So there's a story around crowd mentality that is, I was thinking about it the other day. It was quite funny because he played, I wish I could play you some of the, because I have the raw files of the original crowd mentality somewhere right here. You know, so one of these is I'll play it for you. Mm-hmm. And the original version was very hollow, but I liked the message. And MI actually wrote that song as a protest to what Paul and I had been telling him about music and saying, look, you need to allow people understand what you're saying. So while you're doing this, you're pure hip hop. You need to blend it with some Nigerian stuff so that people can relate to what you're doing. Mm. So crowd mentality was actually a protest song saying, yeah, follow the crowd, you know, do what everybody else is doing, you know, that kind of thing. And interestingly enough, it was only later on that I found out that we had this Gap Online group, a Yahoo groups online. Mm-hmm. And I knew MI then as a very troublesome guy who was always writing poems about girls and stuff on Gap. So I'd met him many times before, just not as who, you know,
not as the.
So it's quite interesting how these things happen. Huh. But yeah, and so you see that the Gap was actually quite important in this whole movement in many ways, because without Gap, we never probably would have met MI. That's the truth about it. Although I didn't meet Jeremiah through Gap, so maybe we may have still met him. But it was just great that my partner was liking him.
Yeah.
And I also got to meet him later on. And then when we listened to Crowd Mentality, I said, look, the sound, the production isn't where it needs to be. Mm. We need some more production on it. So I called Jeremiah. I said, Jeremiah, this is what I want you to do. I want more bass on the song. And when I play the song, you understand what I'm talking about now. Mm-hmm. But Jude was happy with it. He thought, oh, this is really cool. You know, like, no. Needs more bass. So Jeremiah called his younger brother, Dr. Tim, as he was called. And Tim is an awesome producer as well. And started working on the song. But the bass was a bit too heavy. And then it just didn't sound great. So basically, long and short, they went back to the studio 5 times to get the song to the point where I said, good, now you're ready to do music. And for me, those things are important. You see, you cannot start off with a feeling of superiority in your craft. You have to learn. You become a master over time. But if you do not learn to be able to be dynamic and to listen to suggestions, then I think you're going to have a tough career generally, no matter who you are. Because you have your perspective, but you are biased naturally by your perspective.
Yeah.
So that's why it's also good to listen to other perspectives. And the fact that he was able to do those things showed me that, okay, he was ready to put in the work,
yeah.
you know, to get done. You know, so that's the story about Crab Mentality. And when it came out, it really was, there was really nothing like it. But let's just say that though we expected that it would be known, we didn't think it would take him to the next levels that quick. We didn't know that that would be a defining song.
Yeah.
What blew Crab Mentality actually was a performance at the Future Awards, right? Mm. Which was happening in 2006. And I recall that, I also put a second song called Short Black Boy. Mm-hmm. And he had played me the song just 2 or 3 days before the show. So I called the guys at the Future Awards and I said, look, I got a guy. He's really good. I want him to come in the show. And because we had that relationship, which I built the year before, with them, they said, okay, cool. We'll give him 5 minutes to perform. So he literally went and he stole the show. He was the best act then. I remember that this was a point where D'Banj and Mohit, for example, were the hottest guys at that time. Mm. They had Tongue at that time.
Yeah.
So he straight out stole the show. His performance was spot on. You know, it was the confidence, everything was just amazing. So people started asking, who's this guy? Who's this guy? You know? And so that kind of changed it. Now, in between that, we were having some issues with Jeremiah again, just around that period as well. So that's another long story. I don't want to bore you. But then Jesse Jaggs signing is interesting too, because Jesse Jaggs had a song on the radio called Africa, and the song was competing with his brother's song, Crab Mentality. Mm. So they're just, and his music had been there for a while, and I still wasn't sure that I wanted us to sign two brothers on the same label. Mm. So one day Paul calls me and he says, hey, he says, where are you? I'm in the office. He says, I'm coming. He just came in from Joss that evening. Mm. And he said, get in the car. I said, what's happening? He said, just get in the car. So I got in the car, popped the CD in, and said, this is Jesse Jackson's new song. And it was a song called Bend Down Low.
Mm.
And when I heard the song, I was like, Jesus, we need to sign this boy immediately, you know. And yeah, so that's how we started talking with Jesse. I wasn't sure as well, to be honest. I was a bit concerned that he may create some sort of tension or would not be able to handle that. Mm. And then what we did after that was sort of had an agreement in principle that, okay, Chocolate City will work with Loopy Productions. Mm-hmm. And would work with the artists to see how we can also promote them. So sort of like a production deal that would bring in. And then for Ice had also the same thing. He would come by, drop some music here and there. I still wasn't convinced. And for me, for most artists, I always say, look, you need to have that song. I need to hear that song. Mm-hmm. If I don't hear the song, I won't sign you, no matter how great it sounds. I mean, no matter how bright the chances look, because the song is everything. This music business is about music.
Yeah.
You can't pitch your way out, or you cannot hype your way out. The music needs to speak for itself.
Yeah.
And one random day I was in the studio and I walked in. Jesse produced a song and he was in the studio with him and he said, hey, boss, come listen to this song. The name of the song is I'm So.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I still think it's one of my favorite Iceman songs.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, this dude, because he had grown. I mean, from when I met in 2006, a skinny boy who was doing some freestyle, and it was 2.5 years later, and he had now begun to get into his own, coming to his own form, and just being able to play around with his style. So that's sort of how that happened. And should I go on?
I mean, it's fascinating. As many stories as you have, I mean, I think there's an element of being able to draw out information. But there is one thing I wanted to ask. So what did you go to school for at UJ?
Oh, I'm a lawyer. I read law and lawyer.
Yeah.
University of Justice.
Okay. And did you focus on entertainment law or?
No, so no. You know, so the way Nigeria works, or most schools work, is that we do not really focus on anything at the degree level. You just do all sorts of things. Okay. So you do a bit of commercial law, you do some copyright law, just bits of that. But there's nothing specialized at that stage at all. Mm. But what sort of changed? And then even my legal practice, when I started my first job as a lawyer in a law firm, mm-hmm. I worked a lot more on arbitration. Civil litigation, land disputes, and a bit of commercial law, right? But I think, not I think, what changed my life was the fact that my father, being a lawyer himself, had acquired some years before that, when I was probably about 11 or 12, a volume of books called Entertainment Industry Contracts. Mm. And these thick books are like 2,000 pages, you know, like you can't, you one hand will barely hold the volume. Yeah. You know that those thick mm-hmm. ones. So there were like six of them. There was publishing, television, music, theater, and something else. I can't remember. Mm. TV or film or something. And I stumbled upon the books in my first year as a lawyer. And I started, because I was interested in that, I just started reading for myself and reading up on how contracts were being constructed, industry terms. So I kind of self, you know, updated myself with that and then started drafting the contract. So about 2 years later, somebody actually just called me out of the blue and said, hey, they just did Big Brother and I want to manage one of the Big Brother contestants. So I need a lawyer to draft something. Now, in my second year of practice, I was everybody's lawyer, in quotes. Mm. I was a guy who was, because I worked in a law firm called Chief Afe Babalola SAN & Co. And that was probably the most powerful and biggest, that was probably the biggest law firm in Nigeria at that time. Mm. And so because of the kind of clout my principal had, he was the president's lawyer, for instance, and he's probably one of the most proficient lawyers you've ever seen in the court. Mm. So naturally, people would say, hey, how do you work with Afe? Okay, cool. Can you help us do this? Even if they were lawyers themselves, like they would say, help us do this. So I was doing my hustle. I'll do my regular job and then I'll do like other things for them. And that was helping me improve in my skills and know how to draft letters and things like that. So that helped me kind of do more than my colleagues who were in the same position, so to speak. Mm. And as a result of that, one of my clients called me and said, hey, a friend of mine just came, met me, and he said he wanted to do something, and I think you can do it for him. So can he call you? So he introduced the guy. And that weekend, I went back to Kaduna, where I was, got the volume, borrowed the volume from him, and then came back and drafted the first management contract for the guy. Hmm. And so after I did that, I got another call from somebody saying, hey, this guy said he did a good job. Can you help me do this? And so that sort of kind of helped to build my interest even more and my proficiency, because I'd now been able to kind of execute that in practical terms. So that's how I got involved in entertainment law. And then, of course, like I said, the natural interest in the arts anyway. So
yeah,
it just made sense. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Because I was definitely wondering, I mean, just going through, you talked about having to get airplay for people and to do this and that, the different ins and outs of the industry. So was it that you were reading and learning those things? Did you have a network of people who were informing you, or was it just sort of learning as you went along?
No, I was just learning. I mean, so I grew up in Lagos, and then when I went to school, I kind of, towards the third or fourth year of my university, my mother passed, and we sort of, my family was in turmoil, sort of, and my father was in, so they were in an accident together, and he survived. Mm. So for a while, everything got disorganized, and my father never kind of went back to we never went back to Lagos. So we sort of kind of moved from Lagos for a while, you know. And so I kind of lost, I mean, of course, I had a lot of friends in Lagos, but nobody really that was in that sector. Indeed, when I started talking about the label and doing music, many of my colleagues laughed at me. They said, this guy's a joker. Mm. You know, I recall vividly a meeting one weekend, I came back to Lagos for the weekend. I came back to Abuja, rather, for the weekend. And we went bowling with a couple of my friends. And so my friend calls me, a female, calls me to the side and says, "Hey, Aldo, what are you doing in Lagos?" I said, "Oh, well, I'm doing this entertainment law thing." And because I was also, so I was basically pushing two things, the legal consultancy for entertainment and also the management thing and, you know, promoting Jeremiah at the time. And she said, "So what are you doing?" So I explained to her what I was doing. She said, "Yeah, but then, so why were your friends laughing?" You know, that kind of thing. So, and I found out, so they were laughing at me. Interesting. You know, but they didn't believe it. They thought it didn't make any sense. They didn't see anybody playing in that space. So the truth is that there was no precedent per se. The only person that I knew, there are two people that I knew that were involved in entertainment law. They were, one, a guy called Toyin Subair. And Toyin Subair is the guy who started something called High TV.
Okay.
The first, he did High TV, which folded up a few years ago. But he was loyal to companies like Mnet and those South African companies that did a lot of content. And then a guy called Efere Ozako. And Ozako, he's late now. He died about 4 years ago. Brilliant lawyer. And I connected with Efere through a third party who said, "Oh, I know this guy. He does something around this entertainment thing." So we spoke once. We didn't really get a chance to meet during the period I did. But so those are the only guys that I knew, and I had access to only one of them. And even with that, was limited access. So in all fairness, I basically had to learn everything by myself. And then, of course, using our network, which is the other thing that I think in terms of lessons that are important, is about the team. It's about the right team, but it's about the team, because the resources Yahya had, the resources that Paul had, that we all put in the bucket to make it happen. So in everything, there needs to be a driver. I was the driver. Yes. But there are many things that would never have happened without my team being aligned with me, or without us working that closely. So I would be in Lagos, for example, and my brother would say, "Oh, I've got this friend. He works in Guinness. Maybe we should go meet him." You know, that kind of thing. Or Paul would say, "Oh, yeah, there's a guy in BAT. You know, go meet him." So I'll just go out and you know, begin to hustle those meetings and have those conversations. And so that was really it. And I think the other thing you may need to learn and note too is that this is a guy who's coming from Abuja, in quote. Coming to, so it's literally like a guy coming from DC and trying to tell the guys in LA how to do entertainment business. You know, that kind of thing. So it's sort of that kind of look. But it was great because there actually weren't people that were doing what I was doing at the time. So, you know, just one of those things that luck or God or whatever, those circumstances had connived to make it happen.
Interesting. And so you mentioned that when you were getting into the entertainment thing, some of your colleagues you found out were laughing at you. And once you found that out, was that motivation to you? Did it discourage you, or did it sort of have no effect?
It had, I don't know. I mean, you know, the funny thing with recalling old stuff is that it always seems better than it actually was, right? You know, you kind of, your memory just kind of smoothens those, the rough parts of it. It's a bit like Instagram, what it does to pictures. But I'd say that I wasn't fazed. I was even more determined to prove them wrong. And I was ready to give it my best shot. For me, I think what is critical is when I do take actions, I want to be sure that I am sure that I'm happy about the action I'm taking. So that whatever the repercussions are, I was not cajoled or pressured into taking those actions. I think that is important for everybody that does anything. Never let peer pressure or society determine, you know, the way you will go. I'm not saying you shouldn't be guided by it. I'm saying if you were to do that, then there are many things that would never have gotten done in the world if you were listening to the popular people. Second thing is, I've always not wanted to blend in. I'm not saying I wanted to stick out just to say I'm it's just that I wouldn't do something because people are doing it. I'll do it because I'm convinced that it's the right thing to do. So I don't believe in conformity for the sake of blending in. I believe that individuality is the most important thing you can have as a person. And that is what distinguishes you. So I sort of went into it like, well, I've already made up my mind. I believe in this thing. I'm passionate about it. I'm just going to go for it. And guess what? What's the worst that can happen? If things fail, I go back to my legal consultancy and just do the boring thing. Indeed, there's a story. There's a the story related to that around that period as well. And actually, it was kind of prior to that period. I think it was in 2004. I was working in a leasing company. I was a chief legal officer there. And it was a... I became bored with the job. Interestingly enough, when I was doing the interview a few months earlier, they said, "Mr. McCoy, you look like a very restless man. You know, what will it take to keep you here? You know, I'm like, well, I just need to be challenged. As long as I'm challenged, I'll be there. But here I found myself now not so challenged. I found out that this company operated like a government peristatal. And I found out that I was the youngest guy in the company. And I found out that, you know, they were not trying to go to the next level. It just seemed like they were doing, you know, just very perfunctory in what they were doing. And I was broke. I had taken a loan to do an arbitration exam, which was 10 times my salary, literally. So I was paying over time, over months, and that was affecting my cash flow. So I was a bit frustrated, sad, and my Mercedes, so I had a Mercedes Benz, a 190 Mercedes Benz. It had seen some, it seemed better days. So it was like really cool, sexy, what it was. It looked okay, but it had, you know, had a bit of mileage on it. And I was on my way to, it was actually April now, come to think of it, because it was Easter in 2004. And we already started the Chocolate City conversations. You know, we started thinking about, okay, we're going to do this, just planning and just thinking about the next phase of our lives. And I was on my way from Abuja to my village. I'm from a place called Kwai in Jabba local in Kaduna.
Okay.
And it's literally an hour and a half maximum from Abuja to my village. So I just fixed up my car, spent my last money to fix the car, put some fuel, and I was going to spend Easter with my family, you know, because everybody was going to come for Easter. And just about 15 or 20 minutes to my village, my car starts overheating, you know, terribly. So I had to park the car. And I spent all the money I didn't have, right, fixing the car. So you can imagine how frustrated I was. And the car was overheating. I'm like, God. And I just saw a lot of steam. So I assumed that something had caught fire. Luckily, it was just steam. And so I opened the bonnet and then was walking now to a well to go and get water so I could put it. And at that point in time, I was just really, so, I mean, everything was really heavy for me. Like, what the hell is this? You know? And so I told God at that time, and it was also to say that everything that I have is backed up by that spiritual backing of God. And I do believe in God. I know many people don't, but I believe in Him totally. And I believe that He's the reason why we're alive today. And He makes us better people. That's the truth. Because it's that check that keeps us from murdering the guy who steals from us. Or, you know, stabbing the guy. It's true. It's what makes you say, do you know, give him a chance because, you know, God has given you a chance. Things like that. And I told God, I said, look, I'm tired of this funny kind of life. Now, a few months before that, my father had come in and said, hey, Aldo, I think you should consider, you always say you wanted to be a judge, right? Because that's what I said when I was 4 years old. I want to be a judge. And he said, okay. He says, my friends at the Judicial Council have just informed me that commission that they're hiring, they're looking for new magistrates. So, you know, it could be interesting for you to think about, you know, being a magistrate, you know, stabilizes your legal career, then you work your way to the bench. And I was just like, God, no. I could just imagine what that job would be like. You know, sitting down, listening to all sorts of boring cases from all sorts of funny people, and, you know, the salary would be poor, you know, and I'd be living in Kaduna probably, sat in a big compound with a 504 vehicle, drinking beer with a big pot belly and four wine. Things like that. So that's exactly what, you know, and because it was interesting. My father was, like I said, he was a chief registrar of the High Court, and he was about to be called to become a judge when he left and moved to the private sector. So it's ironical that this same man who bailed from the bench. He's telling his son, well, I think it's not a bad look. You know, that kind of thing. And one of the things that he said was that he didn't want to, he said he didn't want to take the position because he knew that the pay was poor and he didn't want to be corrupt. Mm. So he decided to go to the private sector to not get tempted to, you know, steal to take care of his family. So we're fast forward now to this same spot. I'm talking to God. I'm saying, God, if you don't change my life, I know that there's something greater you have planned for me in this world. But if you don't change my life in 1 year, I will go back, accept that job as a magistrate, marry 4 wives, get drunk every night, you know, and just have as many children as I can find, you know.
So that's the life giving God an ultimatum.
Yeah, I gave an ultimatum. I said, this has to happen. And in a year's time, my life had totally changed. Mm. Because it was that year that we signed, a few months later, we signed Jeremiah Gang. We had a top 10, MTN Yellow top 10. We had his song playing in Israel, around the world, nominations for several awards. Mm. A study of the album that Jeremiah did in Toronto. You know, just things. Mm. Things were happening. And within a year, my life did change.
Wow. I mean, I think that's a really great story. I mean, generally, I have these questions where I go through and try to pull that information out. But I think we were able to see where you literally sort of met the end of the road. Your car broke down walking. It just strikes me as a scene from a movie. You know, everything is sort of spiraling out of control, but you still had that faith. And I think a lot of what you see from some of the top entrepreneurs around the world is a conviction in something much bigger than themselves, for better or for worse, however that works out. But I think that's one of the commonalities that binds a lot of entrepreneurs together. And so we've spoken a lot and gotten to know you sort of organically, but I want to ask very pointed questions now. So what fires you up in the morning? What is your morning routine, and why is that routine so important to you?
I have no routine. I'll be honest with you. I have no routine. I wake up, literally, depending on what my day looks like, I could open my app and read the Bible. Mm. Sometimes I don't. I just open my phone, go through my WhatsApp messages, see what is urgent. You know, it's interesting because before it was my email, but now the WhatsApp chats actually give me much more real-time information for all the people that I work with.
Yeah.
So I open that, look at what's happening, and then get up, head straight to my computer, and just open up the emails and start to make calls. In between, I'll probably run in and get coffee and eat breakfast, you know, and then back to work. It all depends. I mean, because my job is not typically a desk job.
Yeah.
That's the truth. But, so it's not really so much about doing a full day of, you know, emails and stuff. But really, that's it. I do not have a routine. But generally, I ensure that I spend enough time to be able to get the desk work, the emails and stuff sorted, make the calls, schedule meetings, and ensure that I'm able to show up for those meetings, or at least have those discussions. And then that's it. I really don't have anything special. I don't have those fantastic stories about, oh, I go to the gym, do 17 hours, come out. I really don't do that. Yes, I go to the gym 3 times a week, and they've told me now that I can't keep running on pavement. I used to like doing that. So I just do the treadmill and then the elliptical, lift some weights. But I'm not really a big gym person, I'll be honest as well. That's my routine. That's it. Oh. Nothing special.
Nice. And so a big part of being an entrepreneur is the passion that drives you, but you also have to have income to drive that passion. So can you share a few ways that you generate income for yourself?
So, I mean, I have a couple of business interests, to be honest. And I think it's sort of typical for most entrepreneurs, multiple streams of income. I'm sure you've heard that many times before that. Before I quit full-time to do Chocolate City, I always had at a time I had about two or three jobs going, running concurrently. Because I work in my main office space. When I leave from there, I come back to Chocolate City, do my bit. And then I also was a partner in a law firm that my brother and I had founded. And I also do my legal bit there as well. So that was sort of how, and one fed the other, you know. And I would say that if you have a source of income and you want to transition to full-time business, I would say that you should really transition and not make an abrupt sort of stop, because you do need money to keep things going. But I also think that you need to make a balance between your principles and the policies of the people that you work with. For me, in 2008, having worked in several capacities within that period in different companies, of course, I declared my interest in what I was doing. I always declared Chocolate City as part of what I was doing while I worked with third parties. But I recall one time I used to work for a Canadian firm. It was an infrastructure consultancy company, and I worked in the power sector, in railways, in public transport, and then even sale of companies and stuff like that. So that was sort of what I was doing then. And my job would end at 5. So from 5, I could do anything I wanted to do. But there was a point in time that I got a bit frustrated because, okay, so I had no more project work to do. All I was doing was chasing payments now at the point in time. And I would be on the laptop and I would be doing Chocolate City work on my company laptop. And I started feeling a bit guilty about that. I'm like, no, these guys can't keep paying me. And then really, you've learned what you want to learn. I think it's time for you to cut the parachute. So I have this thing I call cut the parachute. But primarily, I just decided that I wanted to go take a chance and go all in, basically. And to do that, I need to focus on one thing. And so I just quit my job and basically just focused on doing that. And what happened then was, over time, let's just say that the streams of income opened a bit more. Shall I say that? Because at the same time, because I had my company, I was doing my legal consultancy as well as a consultant on projects. And that brought, and that was in no conflict with my company whatsoever. Do you understand? Because one was entertainment, the other was transportation advisory, two different things. And then I've invested in agriculture. We have a couple of, you know, farmlands and stuff like that. We invested in ginger and some other crops. Shares, and some startups. I've invested in a tech company, a small tech company. Currently, I'm investing in, I mean, a couple of things. So, I mean, it doesn't stop, really. It's really about looking at the opportunities, being able to scrutinize and take a calculated risk. And some have failed. And in fact, some of them, like the tech company, I haven't made any money off of the tech company yet, but I'm seeing impressive figures for the first time. I started seeing it last year. And then there was somebody who was bringing some substantial investment in the company, and the board just decided, we decided that, look, invest the money in the company. We don't want to take any profit yet. Let's the company actually grow. So who knows? We may lose everything. Who knows? We may make profit. But that is it. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. So that's really what it is for me.
Interesting. And so we've talked about some of the down periods that you experienced starting as an entrepreneur, but what is one point that you can pull out that you, that sort of stands as a shining beacon in the midst of darkness that you said, you know what, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is how I need to continue to push on.
I don't know. I mean, there are many of those, so for those listening out there, you will have those in continuum or continuously. You will have those periods. And for many reasons, because the only thing that is constant, they say, is change. So you'll have those disappointments. It could be from a trusted partner. It could be from family. It could be from the authorities. It could really be anything. It could be the market that just messes up. So the different points in my career that have had some lows, and there's been some highs as well. I'll say that probably one of the lows that we had at a point in time was when one of the artists that we worked with, his name is Brivon, went out in public and was making false statements, literally, about us, and alleging all sorts of things. And it was very disappointing for me because, you know, you believe, and you may actually be wrong, but you believe that you're being fair to people. Mm. But I guess everybody's perspective changes. Mm. And to just talk about that briefly, what happened was we got to a point whereby he was becoming very difficult. And I recall that just before the album was released, we started getting a lot of feedback from my team that, look, we were having a lot of problems with him. He was being difficult, arguing about everything, and really being very, very rascally, you know. And so I called one night, I was going to Ghana, and I called his manager and him. I said, well, I'm going to Ghana. We're going to suspend the release of your album because we're not happy about your attitude. And we don't want to spend money. So we're happy to release you to go if you do not feel that this is the right place for you. Mm. But a situation whereby you insult my staff, you call them names, is totally unacceptable to me. Mm. Because nobody called you. And I recall that they called me and said, okay, so they come to the airport, and he came and it was very apologetic. And I said, no, listen, it's not a big deal, right? But there are things I won't take. And I've never had this experience yet with anybody. There must always be respect, even when you're upset, even when you're not happy. Mm. There's a way you talk to people. Because at the end of the day, we're human beings. And he apologized and promised to behave. And I recall that somebody had called me. One of my friends said, look, don't release this guy. This guy's going to be trouble. Mm. He had another issue with MI at some point. I don't want to go into those details. Yeah. But another disrespectful issue where MI brought him to Chocolate City. So I believe that he should never disrespect that relationship, no matter what happens. Mm. You understand? And that's how I was brought up, that even if you don't agree, you agree respectfully. You disagree respectfully.
Yeah.
And that happened as well. So we went ahead and said, look, it would be unfair as well. This guy, this is his career. So let's let him. He's apologized. Let's see what happens. And then a few weeks later, what do we hear? All sorts of things. Blah, blah, blah. And then there's a whole scandal online. Mm-hmm. And I went on a lot of back and forth. But I think what was so great about it is that, yes, we took legal measures, but it was just the fact that everything that we were accused of doing, nobody else could come out. Those there or those who had left could say, we agree, these guys do this. Hmm. Do you understand? So if you say, oh, we're this, that, that, then somebody should also say, yeah, when I was there with them, I also went through this issue with them. Hmm. They're assholes. Hmm. But when every other person is saying, look, hey, calm down, it's not that serious, and you're actually not right about this, even when your manager does not agree with you, then there is a problem. So that was a low, because in the midst of all this, we're actually trying to tie up some really big deals at that time. Then we had this scandal online, in terms of investors and stuff like that. So being able to handle that, and you know that in the war between an artist and label, the label can never look good.
Mm.
It doesn't matter what happens, mm-hmm. because artists always looked at as the little rat, and the label trying to muscle them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way it would have looked good anyway. But we learned a lot from that. I just learned from that experience not to take those things personally, to expect that will happen over and over again, because it is normal in the industry. It happens with all artists and labels eventually.
Hmm.
You know. So, yeah. So I would say that was a difficult period.
Hmm.
Another period I would say that was also kind of difficult was... we had arranged a tour in the States. We'd invested quite some money here. We paid a promoter here, and he had assured us, and he basically embezzled something close to $60,000.
Mm.
And the worst thing was that the guy was sort of my friend, in quotes, you know, and very disappointing, very disappointing. And I was torn between suing him and just letting it go.
Yeah.
And we eventually allowed peace to reign.
Hmm.
But I'm up to today. So what is interesting is that a couple of opportunities have come up and he's tried to approach us to do something. And we said, hell no. never. And I also make sure that people know, I give them my this recommendation so that they don't go through the same thing. You know.
Yeah.
So those are some of the periods. Yeah.
Well, Two things I definitely want to draw out is, you said in the whole ordeal that was going on with Brymo, you talked about it being disrespectful, but not necessarily to you. You said it was disrespectful to your staff. And I think that shows really great leadership. So if you could say a few things about leadership, because oftentimes entrepreneurs don't think about that. They think about building their business, but they don't really think about the sort of culture that they're going to cultivate. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I feel really, really speaking, I feel that, leadership is everything, and I'm learning every day. I'm the school of leadership till the day I die. Because you cannot learn too much, of it. For me, I believe that the biggest mistake that many people make is they think it's all about them. Hmm. It's not all about them. And, you know, in the period where God, I mean, I recall one time that, one of my spiritual lessons again, I recall one time that I had a talk. I mean, I don't know if it happens to other people, but sometimes I know when God is saying certain things to me, like it's a conversation. Hmm. And somebody said that their own experience with God is that he doesn't shout, he doesn't scream. He's not a booming voice, like, oh, I'm God. You know, it's just a voice. Mm. And it's still and it's peaceful. And he said to me, he said, I will not share my glory with any man. Mm. And that includes you. So, and I recall at that minute that what had happened was that I'd referred some of my friends and they got a job. In fact, several of them had gotten jobs through me. Hmm. But none of them even bothered. Like, one of them got the job. He never called to say, hey, I got the job. Thanks, man. Hmm. You understand? Or they were in some places and nobody ever said, hey, I appreciate. And I felt bad. I was like, but if you got me a job, I would say thank you to you. Hmm. That's how I felt. And then I started feeling like punks. It wasn't for me. They wouldn't have gotten that damn job. Hmm. And then that voice came to me and said, no, it's not about you. Hmm. You see, you're overestimating your importance. You are actually nobody. I just used you. Hmm. I could have used anybody to do the same thing. And that was the beginning of teaching me about don't let it get to your head and don't get excited about those things. Hmm. And you see, the team is only as important. I mean, you are only as important as your team. Hmm. The day your team walks out and leaves your company, you are finished, hmm. no matter who you are. So, if you disrespect my team, and I've trained my team to be as professional as possible, I just keep trying to correct them, I keep trying to get them aligned, and I find that not one, not two, but four or five different people are saying the same thing about you, there is a problem. Mm. And you're not disrespecting the team, you're disrespecting me one way or the other. When all is said and done, and I'm not saying that I'm taking it personally, but I'm saying that if you claim that you respect me, but you do not respect my team, then you're lying. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So it was more of that. And in leading, there's the need for succession. Mm. It's very important. And succession means that you may feel you're the only one who knows how to do it, but sorry, it's not that serious. Mm. There's some funny guy in your office who will do the job better than you. And the minute you understand that, you begin to groom. You see, you're only as big as the people that you create. Mm. You're not big because you're big. Anybody can be big. Anybody can be a star. But how many stars have you created? Mm. Is your impact that it is. So in terms of leading, what I've learned is also study people and see what other people do. And I've tried to incorporate that in the things that I do.
Yeah.
So, for example, I don't like too much, yes, sir. Anything, sir. Yes, sir. No, I hate that because you're lying.
Mm.
You know, I want you to say it as it is.
Hmm.
Just don't say, Aldo, that's stupid. Hmm. You can say, you know, you can just say, Aldo, this is not going to work. This doesn't make sense. Hmm. But don't tell me. I mean, don't be insulting about it.
Yeah.
And I think that those are sort of the things that I look at.
Hmm. And you spoke a little bit about grooming your successor, which I think that's a question I had. I remember, was it 3 or so years ago when you handed over to MI to be sort of the captain of that ship. What was that process like? What prompted that transition? Can you speak on that at all?
Yes. So I recall that, so the first thing, let's kind of go back. Chocolate City was not set up as a record label or a management company. Mm. It was an entertainment company. And we did want to do different things in entertainment and not just music. Music was the cheapest thing to do. It was a low-hanging fruit, and we grabbed it. Mm. So at a point in time, by 2010 or 11, we had now began to diversify our services, and income streams had changed. Such that by 2012, our non-music revenue was almost 55% of our total revenue in the company. So it was clear that we needed to actually now make these subsidiaries real companies. Mm. That's the one part. The second part, too, was that we'd invited Jude on the board of Chocolate City as way back as 2010, actually. So the grooming process had already started as way back as then. Mm. Because we didn't imagine that we would be the young guys forever.
Yeah.
And jumping up and down tables, popping champagne, you know, looking at red carpets all the time.
Yeah.
That would change at some point in time. But more importantly, how do you build a company that lasts you?
Mm.
It's by bringing other people a vision and to take it to the next level.
Mm.
That's what I strongly believe. I believe that that is what makes it more powerful. So I'll say that one of the things that I can boast about, forget revenues, forget any other thing, or what sort of landmarks we've achieved as a company. I do not think that there's a entertainment company right now in Nigeria or most parts of Africa that has the sort of succession grooming that we have, or the buy-in of the staff, where they also own the company with the founders.
Mm.
I do not think so. There may be, but I'm not sure that there are. And I don't think that there are many of them that have had the founders step away and let other people run it.
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of trust that process. But again, like I said, we're trying to build something that will outlast and outlive us.
Hmm.
You know, where we're not trying to just come in for the, just to be the in thing. We're too old. We're about 12 years now. We cannot be the in thing.
Yeah.
After 12 years is impossible.
Hmm.
We can basically just mature and become an institution that develops other new opportunities. And that's what we've been doing for the past couple of years. So, sort of going back to the succession issue, Emma already had Loopy Records. He had tried, he had done some things with that. And he did that with our blessing. Indeed, we had a seat on his board of Loopy when he started. I mean, we did that with our blessings. Same thing with Ice Prince. When Ice Prince's first company, I registered it for him.
Hmm.
And I told him, as we were back in 2011, I said, look, you need to start your own thing.
Hmm.
So I said, okay, well, let me just stabilize. Then I'll branch over. I said, yeah, you need to. Because you see, when I started Chocolate City, my initial plan was to be lazy. I called Kenny's Music. I called a couple of labels and said, guys, I got this guy. He's a good artist. We can manage him, but we want him to sign on your label.
Hmm.
That was the plan. You know? But they never picked up the phone.
Yeah.
They never listened. And then after all, like, damn them, I'll just do it myself. So what if Jeremiah had signed with Kenny's Music? Would there be a Chocolate City today? I don't think so.
Hmm.
And looking at what we've been able to achieve, and I say that with all humility, that would have been a big hole in what we have in today's structure, regardless how we look at it. So imagine how many more companies we do need, much better, with billion people, with more energy, you know. The more we can encourage to come out, the better for everybody. So it was important to encourage others to set up their own stuff. But when we got to that time, we're like, look, do you know what? We're working at cross purposes. At the end of the day, you know what? Why don't we look at means to also empower the next generation of people, and the next and the next and the next.
Mm.
So what Chocolate City Music is right now is not the label per se. It is more like what a Def Jam is right now.
Hmm.
So there are other labels, there are imprints on Chocolate City label that are currently operating, where you do not know that we own a substantial part of them or we promote them.
Hmm.
That's our deal with. So we're building more of a, the sort of backbone to empower other labels and other people to do so. Of course, maintaining our mother brand, because it's important to still be relevant.
Yeah.
But still the other things. So that's what the onboarding was. But more importantly, I remember that I read an interview some years ago, and one guy was saying, "Oh well, he intends to remain the boss of his company," and he was in his late 40s then, and he started his company maybe 15 years or 20 years before that. And I'm like, I'm not going to be that guy. You know, at 40 years old, when I turn 40, nah, there's no way I'm going to be doing that. We should be working with the younger guys to bring them up, because I started my company when I was 27, 28.
Wow.
So it doesn't make sense to be doing that up to that time. So basically, that's sort of the thought process. And it was a long and very open discussion about how we would integrate and things like that. So it wasn't like something that just came out of the blue.
Yeah.
It took a while for us to integrate it, but I'm glad it happened.
Nice. And I think that's a perfect segue leading into our rapid fire round. Are you ready?
I think so.
All right. What do you think was initially stopping you from taking the step to become an entrepreneur?
I'm not sure I can answer this rapidly because it's a bit of a complicated question. I wouldn't say I woke up and said, "Hey, I want to start my own business." You know, honestly, that wasn't what I was thinking about. I woke up saying, "Hey, I want to solve a problem." So I wouldn't have said, so at the point in time I decided, I was entrepreneurial from the first painting that I sold in 1996. Do you understand? So I was, but I never thought about entrepreneurship, about, oh, there's a calling, wake up. And you know, it wasn't like that. It was just like, we need to solve this problem. How do you do it? Okay, good. This is the way. Okay, let's do it. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that is my response.
Yeah. Okay. And I think this question is a little different for you. Generally, I ask, when did you stop looking at your business as a project and more as an actual business? But seeing as you're someone who has been involved in a lot of other things, are you at a point now where you look at things as projects before businesses, or do you go into it with that business mindset initially?
Some are projects. I mean, some by their very nature are projects. Some by their very nature are, and some are businesses that you need to be involved in. And understanding the difference between those two determines how much energy you expend and resources, and to be able to balance how you also expend your time. For example, there's a new enterprise we're launching next week. It's called CCX. It's a restaurant, bar and grill slash live music venue.
Okay.
We're opening that in Abuja. It's at Jabi Lake Mall, and it's going to be opening next week. And the idea behind that is, and it's a project, so it's handled like a project, but now it's a real company and it's come to life. But we've run that project for about 1.5 years now. And we had to project manage that. But now he's alive, he's a human being, he's like a baby. You know, so it's going to start learning how to pee and crawl and things like that. But it had to be managed like a project to get it delivered, especially. But it's still part of the Chocolate City family, so to speak. So it all depends on what it is.
And what would you say is your superpower as an entrepreneur and business owner at this point?
My superpower is a hunger for learning new things and being uncomfortable in being comfortable.
And what would you say is something that you wish to improve on?
Project management. I really want to be able to handle things much more effectively because there's a lot going on, and I want to be able to monitor them as professionally and as efficiently as possible. Second thing I really want to improve on is remembering names and where I meet people. It's very important because I meet so many people, and you know, it's embarrassing when people say, "Hey, how do, long time, blah 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 blah." You know, you have a long conversation and then you can't even recall where you meet them. But I think it's very important, so I want to improve on that specifically, because in the world of business, relationship is everything.
Mm. Yeah. And what would you say is one of the biggest hurdles in starting a business in Nigeria?
Oh, there are quite a few. But they're not really, I mean, maybe there's some that are more peculiar to Nigeria. But the first thing is really about the ease of doing business generally. Mm. The time it takes to start a company, get your bank account sorted, double taxation, access to finance probably is the biggest issue because you're talking double digits. If you take a bank loan, you're talking about anything between 26 to 35% per annum.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. Mm. So really being able to walk into a bank and say, hey, fund my business is a no-no. So that now creates a new problem, which is, okay, so how else can you access finance? Family and friends, maybe, but not likely. Venture capital, maybe the money you're looking for is too small. And so it basically becomes harder to source to get the resources that you need and the funds to start with your business. And then the last thing would probably be skilled manpower. Hmm. So to get professionals in certain fields is really, really difficult. Hmm. For example, we're trying to look for a couple of people to do another project, so to speak, new. And we just got feedback yesterday that we're not been able to find anybody who has the requisite experience. So literally it means we need to train. Mm. Now, as you're training, there's high staff turnover generally in the country. People move like water. So you've trained somebody and then he goes to your competitor. Mm. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So those are sort of the challenges.
Hmm. Yeah. And so you mentioned a little bit about access to capital. I mean, it's difficult, but not impossible. So where would an individual looking for capital, like how should they approach that in Nigeria?
I think the great thing about Nigeria still with all these challenges is that there are a lot of people who have the resources and that want to invest, but you must do a solid plan and you must have a solid team behind you and preferably people who are known for their expertise in that field. Mm. And then strong social networks. I would say that's a huge thing because really some of these things that you're looking for, it is over a drink with some guy who works in the company that eases that whole thing. It could be a permit. It could be access to see the CEO. It could be anything. But I would say that you need to circulate because one thing that entrepreneurs do not understand is, like I said earlier, you're the chief marketing officer. Mm. You must not only know the right people must also know you. Mm. So you need to also kind of show yourself as a sort of expert and circulate yourself in a way that people not be. I mean, so there's no doubt that a lot of the businesses that I've been involved in recently as a result of people's perceived, the perception of me, good or bad, you know, positive or negative, mm. you know, and it's almost like saying, oh, well, I mean, so if I walk up to a guy and say, hey, I want to start a hospital, and they're like, okay,
yeah.
you know. But if I say, I'm interested in doing something in entertainment and this is it, you're like, okay, cool, sure, why not? Mm. Track record, right? Mm-hmm. So building that track record and also kind of reinventing yourself is important as an entrepreneur because people will deal with the name that they know, usually.
Yeah.
Somebody they don't.
Mm. And to continue on the rapid fire path, what's the best advice you've received and who is it from?
In retrospect, I think the best advice is from my father. And he said, I don't really care what you do. Just be the best in what you do. He said, if you decide to be a thief, be the best thief so nobody catches you. And I find that that kind of connects with what the Bible says about diligence. He says, have you seen a man diligent in his work? He will stand before kings or among kings. And when you tie those two things, they're the same thing. They're simply saying, be so good in whatever you do. Because what I found out later on was that the richest people, the biggest people, the most important people will get the best person in whatever field that they need that service for and pay whatever amount for that service. Mm-hmm. So if I'm a king, I want the best person who makes shoes to make my shoe.
Yeah.
So the best shoemaker can sell a shoe for $50,000 because it's the best shoemaker. Mm. Meanwhile, a mediocre lawyer who's only good at drafting half-baked contracts will not get $2,000 from the same king. Mm. So it doesn't matter what you do. You're a podcast guy, you're doing a show like this, be the best. Mm. And very soon you'll be talking to, you know, I don't know, Donald Trump or Buhari or one of these guys. And they'll be too happy to be talking to you because like, this is the best guy in this field and other things. So when you think about it from that context, a thirst and a never-ending pursuit of excellence is the best piece of advice that any entrepreneur can get.
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting that you say that because yesterday I was journaling and I was examining my life and I was thinking, am I trying to be the best at what I'm doing or am I just trying to be proficient? And I mean, for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's good to examine that. Are you really trying to be the best? Are you trying to put forth the best effort or are you just trying to be proficient enough at it? And I think that is really what separates people. It's sort of this different mentality that you need to adopt as an entrepreneur and just generally as a person. You need to be a person of excellence if you want excellent things to happen to you. Otherwise, okay things and good things are going to happen to you. So I think it's just very interesting. Yeah, sometimes the world has a way of linking up ideas and pushing them out there.
Yeah, true.
And what is something you're reading right now?
Some things I'm reading. It's just become terrible. Like I read 4 or 5 books at the same time.
Wow.
And I think it's not very... No, please don't copy me. It's silly. It's silly. One of those things I need to improve on as well. But I'm reading a couple of books. One is called The Why Nations Fail. Mm. It is a book that just talks about how politics affects everything and how policies affect everything. Mm. So knowing the politics of a place determines how you play in the business environment of the place as well. Hmm. Then I'm also reading another book. It's called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Business Law. And basically, it's just marrying two things, business and law. And they're closely interlinked. Hmm. Because you can't really run a business if you don't understand the regulations that guide those businesses, lest you get in trouble.
Yeah.
You know? Then another book I'm reading is called Leadership Secrets from the Bible. Just want to be in touch with the thing that stabilizes my funny life. Very important. But yeah, just understanding, just trying to improve on leadership skills and just to get better at that.
Okay.
What else? Like I said, I'm reading several books. I mean, this is aside from reference books.
Mm.
Yeah, so as lawyers, we have to keep reading. We have to keep, you know, just updating information. So yeah, that's what I'm reading.
Interesting. And what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without?
Zoom. Oh, I think Zoom, yeah. Mm. Zoom is great. WhatsApp has now become almost indispensable. I hated it at first, but it gets things done. But those two, I think they're my daily.
Mm. And to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
No, I don't think so.
Hmm. All right. Well, that concludes the rapid fire round and we're about to cool down. And you mentioned a few books that you're reading currently, but what is one book that you would recommend to every aspiring entrepreneur?
Oh, wow. So there's a book I read recently. Just give me a second.
Mm-hmm.
Let me... open up to quote the name properly. A couple of books. One of the books I think I'd recommend, although it's not really an enterprise per se, is a book called The Obstacle is the Way.
Okay.
The Obstacle is the Way is by a guy called Ryan Holiday. And it's an interesting book that talks a bit about not getting daunted by challenges and using those challenges as opportunities. It's So thinking about the issue and stuff, and then stories of people who've gone through rough times in their lives as well. There's a book called Soar. It's by T.D. Jakes. It's actually, so I actually got the book. I'm like, yeah, it's going to be one of those books. But it really does go step by step into the setting up your business, marketing. I mean, a lot of like practical things about business. Mm. So you'd be surprised at how much material there is in that book. Mm. So I think it's a great resource for entrepreneurs. I'd also recommend How I Lost My Virginity by Richard Branson. In fact, that for me, that book was pivotal in shaping how just seeing another side of the story, or rather other possibilities, you know, things beyond what was immediately available at that time. So I'd say that that's a great book to read. And finally, I would recommend The 48 Laws of Power. Now, yes, it's not a business book, but it teaches about the business of life.
Yeah.
And I found it quite great for me. When I was about 29 or so, I was working in, I left that other company. I was working in this company, and I was the youngest guy on the board and the executive committee. So there was a tendency to sort of look down on, at me because I was young, right?
Yeah.
And so I would try and, like, during the board meetings, I'd like to talk a lot and show them how much I knew so they would respect me. And then I started reading the book, and it said, always say less than necessary. It says, never outshine the master. It says, appeal to a person's self-interest over all things. I mean, so how it changed my approach was that, one, and then okay, so the fourth one, it says, do not, whatever you do, do not insult a person's intelligence. So you see, people can take you saying, oh, you're short, you're tall, you're ugly, you're fat. But when you say you're dumb, people never, the soul of the person never forgets or forgives. So what did it mean for me? It meant to me that each time I was talking to these guys and trying to show them that I knew, I was sort of insulting them, and they're feeling, the hell does this guy think he is? Do you understand? And I was just creating enemies. Right?
Yeah.
Then I found out that talking too much and trying to show them I knew would also create people who would either be envious or say, this guy's an asshole. So I began to talk even much less. And what would happen is that when they finish their deliberation, they say, yeah, lawyer, what do you think? Then I'll say something. And I keep quiet. I'm like, yeah, like that. And what happened over a period of time was that I sort of became like the reference point. I basically became like a power broker over time. Because people would want to listen to what I was saying. I was not, you know, showing off what I had, because I found that I was just creating more enemies for myself. And then finally, what I learned from that in business is that when I walk up to a guy and I want to, so I'm walking to a bank to say, because a lot of our business is also sponsored. So you go to a bank or some financial institution and say, hey, well, let's partner, I want to do this, I want to do that. I found out that the way, when you're writing your proposal, shouldn't read, hey, this is what I get, because that's how we write proposals most times. We want money to do our event or to do a project, right? We're only thinking about how we can get the money, but we're not thinking about what you would do if you were the guy giving the money. What would you want? And that's a self-interest. So when you think like them, then you give them a proposal that they would appreciate. But when you think of yourself, or when you're asking to do something out of charitable motivations, then it's no longer about their self-interest. It's about benevolence. And that's not what happens in business.
A lot of great nuggets of advice right there. Just the famous quote is that you're given one mouth and two ears, so you should listen twice as much as you speak. And what would you say is the general value of mentorship that people, entrepreneurs starting out, should be looking to get from mentors? And who are some of your mentors?
Mentorship is everything. It's really everything. But I guess the great thing about technology now is that you can be mentored without actually sitting in front of the person. Yeah, ideally, it would be nice to sit down and chat and, you know, play computer games with your mentor. But generally, that's not going to happen most times. So I would say that The other word for mentorship is apprenticeship. And I find that that is a gap back home in Africa generally that needs to be filled. We do not have enough apprenticeships because, you know, the way it works out is that you start off, you have an idea and you're going to bumble your way through. Yes, we're going to eventually find the right way to do things, but you could actually cut short that process by learning from the masters. So I'll give an example. The guy, Ryan Holiday, the guy I just quoted that wrote Obstacles Away, has written 3-4 great books. The Obstacle is the Way actually was a reference book for a lot of the football teams in the US. And many of them got motivated. Many teams were motivated by reading that book. And the coaches were actually using some of the lessons to motivate their teams. So it became a reference book, right? Another book is Ego is the Enemy. Another one is a perennial bestseller. And then there's another one. And this dude, actually, he was mentored by Robert Greene. Robert Greene is the guy who wrote 48 Laws of Power, who wrote Mastery, who wrote The Art of Seduction. You know, so yeah. When I hear and I read his books, I'm not surprised at the quality of what he's writing because he learned from the best. Now, imagine if he had to start this by himself. Do you understand? It would have been probably a different thing. And then what mentorship does is that it also gives you access to your mentor's network. Do you understand? So you can actually piggyback off of that and also kind of go there. So in terms of my mentors, my first mentor is my father. And I know that that sounds cliche, but he really is my mentor in so many ways, because literally everything I've known, everything that I am today is a function of me watching him operate in certain ways. And I learned a lot about that. And many people come back to me and say, hey, you remind me of your father so much. And I'll tell you sort of like, so even things like the excellence, the quote I told you about being good at your job, he told me, he said, you want to be a great lawyer? Read all the books you can. You must know, and lawyers must know everything. And he says, you don't need to know absolutely everything, but you must absolutely know something about everything. You know, so just opening your mind and being able to read, that mentorship is quite important. Just also learning things like you need to work hard, you know, to get things done. There's no easy way out of life. So it was firm, tough love, but it was real love. Because if he didn't train us that way, I wouldn't be what I am today. That's the truth about it. When all is said and done, you do need a little level of discipline to get things done. The second mentor I have was Richard Branson. And I met, like I said, I read the book. My elder brother, said, oh, Aldo, you need to check out this book. And I read that book. And that book changed my life. And I was posting the other day that in 2011, I actually met Richard Branson in Kenya, because we were now finalists for something called the African Awards for Entrepreneurship. And we won the second prize. We won $50,000. And this is out of 3,300 applications across the continent. And we were the first entertainment company to ever get that award. So that was huge, really, really huge for us. And it couldn't get huger than telling us that, okay, the 10 finalists from across Africa would have 40 minutes with Richard Branson in a small reception. And there I am taking pictures of him, asking questions. And I was totally starstruck. I was just like, I read about this guy 7 years ago. It was a book. And I was like, in my wildest dreams, I never imagined I'd ever meet him. And here I am standing with him, taking pictures, talking. And for me, that was great because he mentored me from a distance. And the only reason why I was meeting him in the first place was because of the mentorship that he sort of gave me from a distance, right? Another mentor I have is Hakeem Bello Osagie. Mm. He's the chairman of my company. And what I've learned from him is humility. I mean, you're talking to literally one of the richest men in Nigeria. Mm. He's quite wealthy and he's achieved so much. He's got 3 degrees, Oxford, Cambridge, and Harvard. You know, that kind of guy. So he's met everybody. He's connected. He's, you know, and when you sit down and talk with him, no airs whatsoever about him. No airs. No, not as, I mean, I've gone to his house with my friends, and when we leave, they're like, that definitely is not Hakeem Bellosai. Is he? There's no way he can be so cool and so calm, you know? And one of the things, the two things he said to me that I hold very dear. The first thing he said was, never give up. Never give up. You need to be persistent and dogged when you want something. And you do not give up because it's difficult. You keep on. If you fail, go back, learn, and come back again. And that is sort of what has kept him, you know, I mean, he got a telecom license after 4 attempts. And I said to myself at that time, I said, have I tried anything 4 times? You know, seriously speaking, how many things have I said? I've tried the first, the second, the third, the fourth? No. Usually by the second time, like, forget it. You know, and you move on. And then the second thing he said was that he has a lot of young friends and old friends. So he would be talking, I mean, today he's talking with the governor of a state or a minister or a president of some country. And he will turn to the left and be talking to a guy who works as a teller in a bank. And the conversation, the tone doesn't change. It's not like, yes, sir, yeah, excellency. Then he now goes, yeah, punk, what do you want? No. It's the same tone. And so I learned something, that humility is not a function of how rich or how poor you are. It is a test of who you really are. And it's important because you meet the guys up, and on your way up, and you meet the guys on your way down. And he told me a very interesting story. One of his mentees ran into him somewhere, one of these airports, maybe in London. And the guy walked up to him and said, hey, Keem, long time. Said, hey, long time. When was the last time we saw? 10, 15 years ago. He used to come to be mentored by Keem for something. And the guy said, so what are you doing? Oh, I'm working on a new project in Abuja, blah, blah, blah. How about you? Oh, I work with the Sovereign Wealth Fund or something like that. Some big company. And eventually that led to them doing some business together. So what if that guy had met him 15 years ago and said, hey, you're a small boy. It was nice seeing you, man. I don't have time.
Yeah.
So he said it's great to be accessible to not just the big, but the small. Not just the rich, but the poor. Because life changes. So primarily, I'd say that. Then the last person that I would say that I've been mentored by from a distance is Sean Puffy Combs, or Diddy. Or Love.
Love, what does Brother mean? Love.
Something. That's crazy. Brother Love. The guy's crazy. Yeah, because it's amazing. A guy comes as an intern. He's remained one of the richest people in hip-hop over 20 years. He's done businesses and all sorts of businesses, and he has kept consistent in what he does. He's passionate about what he does, and people don't talk about him as much, because I think there's a way that his success is translated, but it's no less a mean feat because he doesn't talk about it in that sense. So I'm inspired by the things that he does. I watch what he does. I see how he's moving his business. Yeah. And I'm learning quite a bit.
Wow. Yeah, I think you've sort of laid it out very well. And the lesson coming from Mr. Bello is very piercing at this point. Oftentimes people, I mean, they call it, they want to get the FU money. And I think that is just sort of a terrible mentality to go about. I mean, there are always people who are going to continuously come up. So it's an element of being able to respect them. And I mean, in all honesty, it's just better to be a good person. But like you said, you never know where that person is going to end up and what sort of influence they might have over you in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And as we sort of close out, unfortunately, we're reaching that time where we're closing out. What would you say, people in Nigeria and across Africa, I'm sure you have a pretty good view, you travel a lot. What is a resource that a lot of people don't realize that they have? They might think that they're completely in a rut or stuck, but what is one resource people in Nigeria and across Africa have that they don't really realize?
I think the resource is Africa itself. I think, I mean, I was, I'm, I was talking to, I can't remember what it was now, one of those, maybe a seminar, one of these things I was talking at, and I was telling them that the entertainment industry has done more to unite Africa than the African Union. And you see, Africa is everything. Excuse me. Africa is everything. But Africans don't realize that we are everything. We think that the answer is in the US or in the UK or somewhere else around the world. No, the answer is back in Africa. Every problem that we have, we can solve, but we need to reach within ourselves. Africa is like a big company. They've got different departments that don't talk to themselves. So everybody's doing the marketing is doing something. HR is doing something else. Research R&D is doing something else. And yet we have the same name, like, Africa. But we're not talking with each other. But instead, marketing goes to another company and is trying to do business. That other company outside of Africa is the one routing business back to Africa. So you'd be surprised that there aren't direct flights, for instance, to from Nigeria to many African countries. In fact, in some cases, you have to fly to Europe to connect to an African country. I can't remember the names of the countries right now, but there are quite a few that you do not have access to. Now, when you think about the commonality that we share in culture, in food, in orientation, in lack of infrastructure, in the experiences, there's so much that we have in common. Yet, what happens is typically we go to the US or the UK, cap in hand, and say, oh, we need aid. We do not need aid. We need to open more channels. We need to be able to connect Africa by train or by rail. We need to be able to travel from one country to the other seamlessly without a passport, you know, with just our ID that shows that we're African. We need to, because the world is coming back to Africa to make money, to exploit us. So what we need to do is go back home and get our act together. You know, come back to Africa. And when I say come back to Africa, stop traveling out there and saying, oh, we hope that the money will come from there. No, is that when Ghana is connected to Cairo and when South Africa is connected to Senegal, you know, and when we can travel seamlessly within that continent, we will sell our products within ourselves. You know, and that way we're now keeping the money within the continent and not exporting it. I mean, I can't even use a Naira, the Naira notes in South Africa. Why? Why can't I use the Rand in Senegal? Why? But you can use the dollar in any of those places.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, so I think that is the reason.
I mean, you're talking literally about connecting the African countries. Do you think that's something that's going to be done by the government? Is it going to be public sector, private sector? Is there going to have to be a collaboration? And what is stopping that from happening? And what has been stopping that from happening?
So 2 years ago, I was at something called the Global Africa Economic Summit or something. I can't remember. Global African Business. I want to find it. And I was moderating a panel, and I also was speaking on another panel. And it was interesting because this held in Kigali, Rwanda. And, it was quite well attended, had, a serious representation across the continent. And I felt African, like truly African for the first time. Because on my panel, I'm talking to maybe like a minister in Senegal and the bank guy from Zimbabwe, you know, just stuff like that. And then we sat down. So one of the breakout rooms, we sat down, we're having coffee and just talking about things. And I found that, look, some of the things that they were talking about, I could relate to because we had that problem in Nigeria. But when I sit in, and I've been to all these other foreign panels as well. And when they're saying, well, you know, the problem right now is that in blah, 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 we were not happy with the quality of the light signal. It wasn't strong enough. And then I'm sitting down thinking, Lagos, I don't even have light. We're not talking about a signal. So what is a commonality? You know, we can't really discuss because we have two different problems. But in Ghana, they just sorted the electrical problem, the electricity problems, right? Yeah. I can learn from that. I can relate to that. So I would say that, first of all, technology kept us apart for a long time. Now we can seamlessly interact with people from anywhere in the world using any of these resources. So that is a big game changer. Because before, think about the old system where you need to dial a phone or send a fax, you know, and then you hope the person is around when the call rings, I mean, when the phone rings and things. But now I can WhatsApp you, I can call you, I can Zoom, Skype, whatever. I can do all those things. So it's open the way. The second thing is that with better technology, it's also bringing better access to even funding for private sector, not just for the public sector. So you see a lot more of those things happening. And I also believe that there was a recent conversation at the African Union about getting a uniform passport for Africans. And they're now talking about renegotiating routes for airlines and stuff and building more indigenous airlines. So you find out that what that means, and the new African Union president is the president of Kigali, and he's a visionary. He's a super guy. He's awesome. So I believe that under his leadership, you will see a change in that. But the last point, I think, is also about the kind of leaders that we have in Africa. Remember that the average African leader is 62 years old, and the average African is 19.5 years old. So the 62-year-old guy is on his way out. He doesn't understand these things we're talking about. He's in the where everybody lived in their little huts. And when I say hut, not literal huts, I mean huts, you know, just huddled around each state by yourself. And now we're in a world of collaboration and convergence, not just about pure competition. It's just about us getting together. So that will change, I'm sure. In the next 10 years, we will have a different discussion, but it must be a deliberate act. It must be deliberate and concerted.
And where do entrepreneurs, philanthropists, where do they have a role in this development for the future?
Oh, we're everything. The entrepreneurs are everything. We are the ones who generate the most employment across the continent. Mm. We are. The word entrepreneur is a very fancy word. I was trying to define it the other day. It's from a French word called entrepreneur or something like that. So let's not even use that word. Let's just think about it as business owners, SMEs, hustlers, you know, words that people can relate to. And when you break it down to that level, you understand how much wealth and job creation these guys are doing. They're the barbers, the salon owners, the guys who sell groceries, you know, the guys who started one kitchen and then expanded to two and three and etc. So we are the workforce of Africa. What we need is more skills, better education, and more access to funding. And we also need to think about giving back. And I think that is something I have began to, I've always sort of tried to do my own little bit, but I realized that it's not enough. Mm. It really isn't enough. And that's because I'm thinking about doing it by myself. So what we started talking about is creating a network of other people so we can join forces and unite our resources and see how we can expand, let's say community school, for example. Can we come and teach them business classes as supplement so they can begin to think about turning 1 naira to 2 and 2 naira to 3? You know, can we begin to do that? Can we begin to mentor some people? And yes, I mean, in my company, we have a policy. We bring in, apart from like NYSE people, we also bring in interns on a yearly basis. So they come and do 3 to 6 month internships, sometimes a year. Some of them have stayed on to become staff. And the idea is just to also give them a head start and to give them some opportunities. So I think it's just about expanding that and collaborating across the continent to form this network of enterprise development mentorship.
Great. And I mean, I think we could definitely keep going. I can see your mind working, pushing. I can see that you're definitely passionate about the continent as a whole. And I think that's something that's really important. Oftentimes we get siloed into our specific countries and think that we need to do it alone. But it's between what Dangote and Strive, two people in particular that I take notice of, Dangote and Strive Masiwa from Zimbabwe, I believe, what they're doing is amazing in terms of trying to connect the continent. And I think it'll definitely pay dividends. Well, Audu, it's been an amazing opportunity to be able to speak to you. You're just a wealth, a fountain of knowledge. I've received so much, and I'm sure the bandits have received a lot as well. And as we're about to leave, can you let us know how to connect with you? Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that, email.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would like to say thank you too for the platform and the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And you got me my brain on overdrive, thinking about something smart to say. it's been quite enlightening for me as well. You can connect with me. I am on Instagram. My name is Audu Maikori, AUDUMAIKORI. So just at Audu Maikori. If you're on Twitter, it's at Audu, AUDU. On Facebook, it's Audu Maikori as well. You can just Google my name. You'll see any other, and LinkedIn as well. You'll see all my handles, and you can follow me. Okay. Just to say that I'm different people on different platforms. So on Facebook, I'm a totally different person from what I have on Instagram and Twitter, all that. So,
great.
Yeah.
Well, to all the bandits listening, on Audu's page on the Knowledge Bandits website, you'll have information that we've talked about throughout the podcast, specifically the books, and also you'll find his social media handles there as well. Audu, we're just wrapping up. Can you leave us with one more piece of parting wisdom?
You always do this, Aaron. You always make me have to think about something smart to say when there's really nothing smart to say. The only piece of wisdom I'll leave with you is follow the Knowledge Bandits. It's a great program. Tune in and share the knowledge of other people. We need to encourage other people. We need to build others. And remember that the great people create other great people after them. Mm. They are not self-centered. They do not bask alone in the glory. Success is always better when you do it together. And that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
All right. Bless. Thank you so much. All right.
Stay inspired.
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com. Finally, if you love music and you have a few moments, please listen to this instrumental by Young Alhaji. You can find him on SoundCloud by searching Young Alhaji. That's Y-U-N-G. A-L-H-A-J-I. Stay inspired.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is me expressing my loneliness.
much. Bye.